Excellent. Can I just one thing before we start? I love all of your questions except for number 13, which is about education and schooling. I appreciate you're not at my other work, but that's like a whole different podcast. Okay. Yeah, there's no way to answer. Yeah, so maybe we can schedule another time to talk about that. It's just there's no way to answer that one briefly. Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Yeah. So just a tiny bit of background here. This book grew out of another book that I wrote, which was called The Well-Educated Mind, A Guide to the Classical Education You Never Had. And this was about how to educate yourself by reading chronologically through the great books in five different genres. And the ones that I had picked for that original edition were poetry, fiction, drama, autobiography, and history. And I heard from a lot of readers who were more science-oriented, more engineering-oriented, who said, I don't want to read poetry. I want to read about science. Where are the great books of science? Which was honestly not a way that I had thought of approaching science before. But when I started to think about it, you know, it became clear to me that the ideas of science that affect all of us, that affect the broader culture, are those which are most effectively put out there in writing for us. When I wrote the story of Western science, my goal wasn't to write a history of science. It's a history, you might say, of the diffusion of science, how certain scientific ideas sort of root themselves into the popular imagination, and then they spread and become this lens through which most of us, not just scientists, view the world. So I didn't pick scientists, I picked books. I wanted to choose the books, the texts, that most affect how we do science, and I wanted to tell their story. So I looked for the books that were the most cited, most discussed, most used, most fought against by the next generations, both of scientists and of general readers. Well, I start with Hippocrates in the book, The Corpus, which is a collection of 60 medical texts from the 5th and 4th century BCE, prescribing treatments for common ailments. That's not really the first science text. The ones we can really think of as being seminal are from a couple of centuries before Hippocrates. So there's a set of Greek thinkers in the 6th and the 5th centuries BCE. They're known as the Pre-Socratics. And they were actually the first to start theorizing first about the human body and then about the cosmos in a way that didn't require the gods to be present in everything. They were the first to deal with nature on nature's terms. The problem is that most of the pre-Socratics that are lost. We only know about them because later writers quote them and refer to these lost writings. So what we see with Hippocrates is the first existing text in this tradition, the first ones that try to explain nature without blaming and without invoking the gods. And Hippocrates starts with epilepsy, which was considered to be a sacred disease. It was considered to be, you know, inflicted by the gods to actually give extra insight. And he says the only reason to chalk it up to the will of the gods is ignorance. He says, this notion of its divinity is kept up by man's inability to comprehend it. So so he is the first to have this surviving text, which clearly says, let's look at nature and understand nature on nature's terms. And, you know, if I could just say, Hippocrates remains incredibly influential. His whole theory of disease is that it's caused by the imbalance of the humors. The four fluids in the body are affected by heat and cold and bad air and all of these different things. And it's funny that I still found myself when my kids were little and at home yelling things like, don't go out barefoot in the cold, you'll catch a cold. And yeah, and of course, this is not how it works. We all know this, but that's Hippocrates still hanging on. Yeah. Ah, Aristotle. Now, Aristotle's tough going. He is definitely one of my lesser favorites. But what was so important about Aristotle is that he focused for the first time on change and on change as a positive, forward-moving phenomenon. So earlier writers before Aristotle tended to just deal with the world as it presents itself to us, you know, just analyzing what is there, which in itself was a big step forward from the days, you know, when magic was the answer to everything. But Aristotle was the first one to say, the world changes. You know, a kitten becomes a cat. A seed becomes a flower. What starts that? What starts that process? Let me just stop for a minute. Is that me beeping or you beeping? Can you hear that? All right, I'm going to start over. With that, I hear something beeping, and I just wanted to make sure it wasn't me and that it wasn't coming through on your as long as you can't hear it, it doesn't matter, but give me one sec. I'm just going to make sure that all of my messaging apps are off here. Okay, that should be off now. Okay. Yeah, I'll just start over with Aristotle. Alrighty. Okay, sorry, let me just remember where I was. Okay, so you asked why was Aristotle so important? Okay. Yeah, restate the question, we'll take it again. Oh, Aristotle. Keep running into Aristotle all the way up to the 19th and even the early 20th century. And Aristotle, he's one of my lesser favorites because I kind of find him tough going. But what was so seminal about what Aristotle did? Was that he focused for the first time on change. So if you look at who came before Aristotle, you've got two kinds of thinkers. You've got the pre-Socratics who are focusing on the world as it is, explaining what we see in a particular moment, which was a huge step forward from the days when magic was an answer to everything. But they really didn't focus on how things changed and why. And then we have Platonic thought, which said that nature was originally in a state of perfection and all change is dissolution. All change is corruption. All change is degradation. Things only get worse. Aristotle was the first to say, hang on a minute. Why does change happen? Why does a kitten become a cat and not just stay a kitten? Why does a seed become a flower and not just stay a seed? Why isn't, you know, what you might call the state of kittenness or the existence of a seed in itself, not enough. And so the physics, which is his most central scientific work, is all about change. Change in every sense. Change that happens when a young creature ages. Change that happens when an object moves from one place to another. I mean, if you move a rock from the riverbank into the river, is it the same object or has it changed? So as he goes through this, it becomes very technical and very philosophical, but he is struggling towards something that eventually makes the theory of evolution possible, which is that there is some inborn quality that forces change in natural objects, and that change is not always bad. That change can lead, not from a perfect Platonic ideal to something less ideal, it can lead from something simple to something more complex and something, you know, in a way, more interesting. So really, there's two things about this that I think are really fascinating. One is that it is this idea that produced science as we now know it, this idea of change as an important aspect of our physical world. But then the second is something that I kept looking for as I was dealing with these scientists. He asked a question that nobody had ever asked before. And that to me is the definition of a scientific breakthrough. A scientific breakthrough, a true one, is not, I finally found the answer to the difficult question. It is, I'm asking a question that nobody knew needed to be asked before. And that to me is just sort of the essence of scientific discovery, finding the question. And Aristotle was the first to really illustrate that. Exactly. So I know we're probably going to talk about the scientific method in a little bit. Without Aristotle, we would not have the foundations for a scientific method. And you're right, Aristotle is actually wrong about almost everything. But he's asking the questions and seeking answers. And he's doing so, this is how he's different from Hippocrates, he's doing so because he wants to know. I mean, props to Hippocrates, great scientist, but he was dealing with a practical art. He was dealing with questions that had to be answered because he had to treat patients. Aristotle was the first who was asking these scientific questions out of sheer wanting to know how things work. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, the subtitle to that chapter about Ptolemy in my book is The Most Influential Science Book in History, which is absolutely true. So this was a Greek astronomer in the 2nd century CE. And what he did was he synthesized centuries and centuries of recorded astronomical observations into this work. So the Almagest proposed an Earth-centered universe, and it had a really ingenious series of calculations that accounted for the movements of all the planets. And what you had to do, I won't go into too many details, but it's pretty fascinating. You had to calculate their orbits from two different points, and then you had to program in these little pirouettes called epicycles. And then periodically you had to chart their progress backwards, which was called moving in retrograde. And all of this was necessary because, of course, they weren't circling the Earth. They were circling the Sun. Calculating them on circling the Earth required a lot of finagling. But here's the important thing to remember, and this is why the model was accorded such reverence, as you put it, it worked. The Ptolemaic system was horribly complicated and it was ugly, but it worked. If you followed it, predicted the movements of the planets and the movements of the stars accurately. Navigators used it for centuries. So, I think when we're thinking about Galileo and then also about the Copernican Revolution, we always have to keep in mind that resistance to the heliocentric model wasn't simply mindless. It was because both Galileo and Copernicus got the answers wrong, in terms of predicting the movement of the stars and the planets, a lot more often than the Autodesk did. It was a lot more reliable. So why would you throw over this admittedly complicated system, which is more accurate, for one that's simpler, but doesn't give the right answers often? And, you know, this comes back again to scientific discovery so often being, what question have I not yet asked? And, you know, for centuries, no one asked one simple question of the Ptolemaic model. Why is this so darn complicated? You know, that was the question that finally Galileo and Copernicus asked. But when something works, we often don't stop and ask that question. Can I give you an example from more of the present day? Okay, so throughout almost from Hippocrates, but certainly from the Middle Ages through the beginning of the 20th century, disease was often explained in terms of miasma theory, which means it's caused by bad air, stagnant air, poisoned air, air that's got river fog in it. And so treatment for when an epidemic began was often to move people out of the air where they were, because that was bad air, and to get them somewhere better. And that tended to be out in the country, or, you know, on a riverbank with a breeze blowing, or on the beach with a sea wind blowing. And this actually worked. And the reason why it worked, as we now know, is because ventilation, as we are all finding out continually, ventilation can prevent infection by germs. Miasma theory worked, so nobody stopped for a very long time to say, but what else could the answer be? You know, this doesn't explain all cases of illness. What else might possibly be going on? And, you know, it's the same thing with the Ptolemaic system. It worked, so why would you say, yes, but could there be another answer? In many ways, both the Copernican and the Galilean model required you to do something anti-scientific. It required you to disregard the evidence of your own senses. It's perfectly obvious to most people that the Earth is not hurtling through space. And so in order to accept that it is, you have to do something that people were just getting used to doing, which is actually paying attention to what they see and touch and know through their senses. The great inspiration. Yes. Yeah, Francis Bacon is certainly deserves to be better known than he is, but I think most people know his work, they just don't attach his name to it. And this follows beautifully on what we just addressed. Bacon was really concerned to find out if we were asking the correct questions. So what he had a problem with was Aristotelian reasoning. So Aristotelian thinking, and again, this has dominated science for hundreds of years, I guess 1700 years nearly, relies on deductive reasoning. So deductive reasoning starts with this general statement. So you make this general statement, and, you know, the one that kept the Earth at the center of the system was all heavy matter falls towards the center of the universe. That's your major premise. So then you come down from that and you make a couple of supporting statements. The Earth is made of heavy matter. The Earth is clearly not falling. Those are your minor premises. And so your conclusion is the Earth must be at the center of the universe. And that's just one example of deductive reasoning. The thing to keep in mind is that you start with a general statement and you move from general down to a specific conclusion. And Bacon came to believe that if you did this, you would never get to the correct question, because you start with an assumption that can't actually be, you can't find out that you're wrong and go off in another direction. You've already locked yourself in. So I'll use his words. He says, having first determined the question according to his will, that's your major premise, man then resorts to experience and bending her to conformity with his facets, which is his things that he says are true, leads her about like a captive in a procession. So Bacon says, no. What you've got to do is start with your specifics. And then you've got to look for evidence that backs that specific assertion up. So you would start with, the earth is at the center of the universe. And then you would test that idea against physical reality, observations of the world around you, and also experiments. And only after that can you actually come up with a theory. So it's going in the other direction. And basically what he has laid out is the outlines of the scientific method. Have a hypothesis, come up with a hypothesis, experiment in order to test the hypothesis, and then come to the conclusion rather than starting with the conclusion. So this is the real value of this book, is that he challenged Aristotelian logic and put in place the footwork for the modern scientific method as we now know it. And there's this lovely illustration on the cover of the ship, of a ship. It's the ship of knowledge, and it's sailing past these two pillars. They're the mythological pillars of Hercules. They're supposed to represent the outermost boundaries of the ancient world. So Bacon is very specifically saying, it's time to boot Aristotle. It's time for a new way of thinking. Oh, he was received well. It's sort of a two-part answer to that question. As brilliant a thinker as Bacon was, he was sadly had his priorities in the wrong direction. He was much more interested in gaining a place at court than he was in continuing necessarily with his scientific researches. So he never finished the work, and his last years were completely taken up with political maneuvering, which didn't do him any good. And in fact, he lost his place at court, and he kind of died in a low place without even coming close to finishing this book. But he gained a huge following among practitioners of science in the 17th century. Particularly, he was adopted by the members of what's known as the Royal Society of London for Improving Natural Knowledge, which still exists as the Royal Society of Science. And this was this gathering of natural philosophers who committed themselves to this Baconian method. They committed themselves to experimental science. And what we see coming out of that are most of the advances, particularly in chemistry and in physical science, that we now think of as modern science. Yeah, I would say the best approach is to not even try to read it. This is one of my favorite anecdotes, and this isn't actually in my chapter about Newton, is there's this frustrated Cambridge undergraduate, as Newton passes him in the street, says, there goes the man who has read a book that neither he nor anyone else understands. So there are, though, a couple of places where it's mostly equations, to be frank. And I am not a mathematician, and therefore I am very quickly out of my depth. Yes. So if you're not a mathematician, there are a couple of parts of it that are actually worth looking at. So just as a quick summary, books 1 and 2 establish the three laws of motion that soon became the basis of 20th century physics. Do you want me to go over those quickly? Okay. Yeah, you've all heard of these. The first is the law of inertia, and that means objects in motion remain in motion and objects at rest remain at rest unless an outside force is applied. That's the law of inertia. And then there's a formula, but I won't give it to you. Then there's the law of acceleration, which essentially states that if you apply force to a mass, acceleration results, and the greater the mass is, the greater a force you need to push it forward. And then the third law of motion is the law of action and reaction. And that is, ta-da, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And you know, these, I think we just take these for granted now. Newton's genius, again, was in realizing that there was a law that stated this, and it could be used to understand some of the more complex aspects of the universe. So that's in books 1 and 2. And then the other two books discuss gravity as a universal force. So there are two places that you can profitably read, because he starts writing in prose rather than in equations. The first is at the very end of the whole book. And actually, this is something I tell people a lot when they're reading very difficult nonfiction. I say, go to the very end and read the conclusion first. Then at least you know where you're going. So exactly. Well, two very different purposes. Yeah, don't do that with fiction. So he makes these it's called the general scholium, which this way of saying the overall explanatory remarks. And in those overall explanatory marks, he explains the limitations of his method. So he has spent all of this time talking about gravity as this force that works everywhere the same way in all places. But what he says is, we don't know what causes gravity. So he's deducing laws of gravity from his experiments on Earth, but he says, I cannot tell you why gravity exists. I cannot tell you the reason why gravity has these properties, and I am not going to try to give you a universal explanation for why the universe functions as it does. So what he was doing was outlining what he thought was the boundary of science. He's putting a fence around what scientists do and marking the point at which science becomes speculation. And it's an important boundary, and it's one that I have to say 20th century physicists and 21st century physicists, particularly those who are writing for popular audiences, violate all the time. You know, they go straight from, this is how the universe works, to here is what the universe means. And Newton would have been appalled by this. He would have seen it as an incredible overreaching. So it's very interesting to read his reflections on it. So that's the first thing that I think is worth the general reader's time. And then the second is he's got this section called Rules for the Study of Natural Philosophy, and that's right at the beginning of book 3. And he puts these in order to try to explain why he can do an experiment in his laboratory and then extrapolate it out to the farthest corners of the universe where he has clearly not physically been. This is Newton really struggling with that same problem that led so many people to reject Copernican astronomy. I can't go see it. You know, I can't touch it. It's anti-Baconian because I can't sense it myself. So he lays out these rules in a way that defends his conclusions about the far reaches of the universe. So these are fascinating because he starts with the one that ultimately, you know, gave the triumph to Copernicus. Simpler causes are more likely to be true than complex ones. If you've got to go through multiple steps to explain why something works, you should be cautious. Look for the simpler explanation. And then he says, second, these are the most important symbols. Phenomena of the same kind are likely to have the same causes. So if you drop a stone in Europe and you drop a stone in America and gravity is pulling the stone in Europe, gravity is probably pulling the stone in America. We can just, you know, proceed on that basis. And then finally, he says, if a property can be demonstrated to belong to all bodies on which experiments can be made, it can be assumed to belong to all bodies in the universe. So here is Newton making it possible to do cosmology, making it possible to study very distant galaxies, making it possible to study black holes, even though we can't physically get near them. So I think for the common reader, what's important about the Principia is not his actual, you know, mathematical conclusions, but these sort of theoretical frameworks that he's erecting for us. Well, in this way, Einstein is very unlike Newton, and part of Einstein's genius is in his ability to express complicated ideas in lay language. I mean, I remember first coming across these papers, I had to read them for an undergraduate class at William & Mary, and I was an English major, and I understood them. That is genius there. So, here's what these papers explore. Einstein found that there was a central contradiction between two ironclad scientific principles. And the first one was the principle of relativity. And this was really a cornerstone of scientific thinking ever since Bacon, really since Galileo, but really since Bacon. And what the principle of relativity says is that a law of physics must work the same way across all related frames of reference. So here's Einstein's example. And again, this is just, it's such genius to be able to think of the metaphor that makes this clear. All right, so imagine that there's a railway car and it's traveling along a track straightforward at a constant rate of speed. And to the left is a high embankment that's like right at eye level, okay? So the car is constantly changing its position relative to the embankment because it's going straight ahead and the embankment is not moving. So the position of the embankment and the train are always changing. But what the car is not doing is rotating at the same time. So this is called uniform translation. You don't necessarily need to know that to understand the example, but that's what he's talking about. Now, imagine at the same time, a raven is flying through the air above the train car, but a little bit slower, but at a steady rate of speed. If you are standing on the embankment, you see the raven flying at one particular rate of speed. But if you're standing on the moving railway car, looking up at the raven, you're seeing the raven fly at a much slower rate of speed, because you're judging how fast the raven is flying in accordance to where you are standing. So is the guy on the embankment. The raven is flying at the same absolute rate, but how fast that rate is depends on where you're standing as you look at it. That's the principle of relativity. So far, so good? All right. For both observers, the raven's still flying in the same direction and at constant speed, but the speed of the raven seems to be different. Now, that's pretty straightforward. The problem is that there is another principle in physics, which is accepted by every single physicist, which is that the speed of light is constant. The speed of light had been tested in a vacuum over and over and over, repeatedly, in all different ways that could be done. And in a vacuum, the speed of light is constant. So here's the theoretical problem. Imagine that your railway car is going along, and there's a vacuum tube above it, and a ray of light is traveling above it in the same direction as the raven. So the principle of relativity insists that if you're standing on the embankment, the speed of light will be different than if you're observing from the railway car, which would mean that the speed of light is not constant. So there are these two principles that are contradicting each other. And it seems like either the principle of relativity or the principle of the constant speed of light needed to be abandoned. Now, this was a known problem, and the way that most physicists dealt with this was to abandon the principle of relativity. The problem is that there was no experimental data showing that in any other context, the principle of relativity was incorrect. So Einstein's insight was that you don't have to give up either, as long as you can change your idea about how time works. So imagine that your two observers are measuring the speed of light per second. What Einstein suggests is that if you're on the rail car, time itself has changed. What has changed is not the speed per second of light, but the second itself. Time itself dilates and slows down as the observer moves faster. So this is what we think of as the fourth dimension. Okay, it turned three-dimensional space, where physicists had been working for literally centuries, into four-dimensional space time. So that is Einstein's, that was Einstein's great insight, that time itself is not a constant. Again, what questions do you ask? Who before Einstein thought to say, yes, but is a second always a second? No, he thought of that. And so that is the beginning of looking at both time and space, not as constants, but as manifestations of reality that change depending on our observation point. More accessible, but more or less accessible. Yeah. They're definitely, you know, quantum physics is one of those things where, well, okay, I don't know about other people, but when I read quantum physics, I have a large space of unknowing in my brain that I allow to sort of, you know, go by. But yeah, but the quantum physics is something that you can. You can at least grasp the basics of it. It's kind of like reading the Principia. You don't have to keep up with all of the equations. I mean, what I've just said about Einstein is his theories is missing all of the, it's missing all of the the actual proof. But you can sort of you can grasp the basics of it. So I mean, I think one of the things that I recommend in the book, The Story of Western Science, is to read Schrodinger's What is Life? I think everybody's heard of Schrodinger's cat, but you actually need to go to Schrodinger, and he's one of the founders of quantum physics, and read what questions he was asking when he came up with these illustrations and these ideas. And I do think it's fairly accessible. Yeah. Yeah, well, he was scooped, but he was honorable about it. So what happened was that he had formulated this idea, and it was not a new idea. It had been argued in Malthus's essay on the principle of population to some degree. Darwin just applied it to physical evolution. That under circumstances where people or we'll just say species are struggling with each other for existence, there's a limited amount of food, there's a limited amount of resources, that any variations, genetic variations that tend to make you better capable of getting more food, of surviving, are gonna tend to be preserved, and unfavorable ones will be wiped out. And the result of this would be the formation of a new species. And he wrote on this idea. He started writing it sometime in 1842. He had a first draft, not of a book, but of an essay in 1844. And then he just kept tinkering with it and adding ideas and adding specifics. So he was still tinkering with this more than 10 years later when he got a letter from a British explorer named Alfred Russel Wallace. And Wallace he had been in Indonesia exploring, and he had malaria, and so he had to spend hours every day in bed, and he had nothing to do. So he read, and he wrote, and he just sort of jotted down some of his insights into this quick essay called, here it is, great title, On the Tendency of Varieties to Depart Indefinitely from the Original Type. And I know you gotta love those Victorian titles. And basically what he says is, I mean, he puts it better in the essay. He says that the races inevitably improve because in every generation, the inferior and the less able to survive are inevitably to be killed off, and the superior would remain. And this is his phrase. He says, the fittest would survive. So this survival of the fittest, this phrase that we tend to attribute to Darwin, is actually from Wallace. So Wallace jots all this down. He sends a letter to Darwin and says, pass this on to anyone who you think might find it interesting. And Darwin opens this and he says, this is my essay. This is exactly my essay. But he was so he could have actually suppressed it because Lyell had malaria in Indonesia. But instead, he wrote up an abstract of his own work, and then he included this letter from Wallace, and he sent both of them to the Royal Society. And so when the theories were published, Wallace's and Darwin's were actually published side by side. They articulated the theory of evolution by natural selection at the same time. And what's really funny is that nobody paid any attention. In fact, this is one of my very favorite quotes from science. It's this annual report of the Society for 1858, which was the year in which Wallace and Darwin were published side by side. He writes, the year has not been marked by any of those striking discoveries which at once revolutionized science. So, yeah. Well, because Darwin went on to write a popular book. And Wallace wasn't Wallace's jam. And, you know, he was an explorer, he was an adventurer, he wasn't a writer. And Darwin had a good turn of phrase. He was the one that came out with the book that was aimed at a general readership, and that was On the Origin of the Species by Means of Natural Selection. So, you know, the original two essays were published basically in papers for other scientists. The book was published for a wide readership. So that's really, and it became an immediate bestseller. So that's why we remember Darwin. And Darwin continued, Wallace didn't continue to work on the theory once he'd articulated it. Darwin continued to work. He revised over 28 years, he revised The Origin of the Species 5 different times, and, you know, really kept it in front of the public eye. It is. And this is an interesting thing that happens as we move on into the 20th century. Before the 20th century, most scientific works were written for a general audience. They were written for scientists, but also for lay readers. And in the 20th century, science becomes so much more focused and specialized and technical. Plus, we have the growth of professional academic departments, which starts in the late 19th century. You know, before the late 19th century, you could do science as a gentleman from the laboratory in your living room. By the time we get into the 20th century, you need to be part of an academic department, you need specialized funding. We see scientists start to write for each other and not for lay people. So actually, if you look at the books that I cover in The Story of Western Science, you'll see that before the 20th century, most of them are written by scientists. As we get through the 20th century and into the 21st, more of them are written by science popularizers, who are people who take this incomprehensible material and translate it for a non-academic audience. So it's just a real change that happens there. Yeah, but Darwin's is definitely written for a general readership. Oh, I would definitely go to Steven Weinberg's The First 3 Minutes. It's so accessible. It's an older book. It was originally published in 1977, but there is an updated edition from 1993. And the thing that's really important about Weinberg's book is that the language he uses is still the language that people use about the Big Bang today. I mean, even the idea that there was a Big Bang, which many physicists now say, yeah, it wasn't big and there wasn't a bang, but we still use the phrase. And here again, Weinberg's just very accessible. He's got a knack for that metaphor that takes something that's highly technical and makes you think, oh, I understand most of that. So yeah, that would definitely be my recommendation. And then if you wanted to, you could go on to Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time, but I think you'll have more luck with Hawking if you read Weinberg first. Yeah. Well, let's see. I already did Aristotle. And best and worst are pretty subjective, of course. I mean, definitely some of them are harder going. Robert Boyle, Isaac Newton, Charles Lyell, Fred Hoyle. These are all important works, but they're not scintillating prose. On the other hand, you know, we already spoke about Darwin and Steven Weinberg and Einstein. I would add to that Lucretius, who's one of the early Greek philosophers, one of the first to really expand on the theory of atomism. And then one of my very favorites, actually, is Walter Alvarez. So Walter Alvarez wrote this book called T-Rex and the Crater of Doom, which, first of all, as a writer, I admire not only the title, but the cover. It's like there are these dinosaurs, and they're standing like in Mordor, you know, with all of these, there's all this lava in there. So this book is his account of looking for the impact crater of the asteroid that he theorizes killed the dinosaurs. And what's so really fascinating about it is it's a very Aristotelian, not Baconian thing that he's doing. He and his father are working together, and they come up with this theory based on, you know, certain occurrences of a certain kind of mineral in certain geological layers, that maybe a huge asteroid hit the Earth at some point, and maybe that's what caused mass extinctions that you can see in the fossil record. All right. Now, they have absolutely no proof for this. All they have is some trace minerals for which there could be any number of other explanations. But they say, well, let's suppose the theory is true. If a giant asteroid did hit the Earth, what would we be looking for? And they draw up a list of things that they would need to look for, and then they start looking for them. And they find them. Some, I think it's 10 or 15 years it takes, and they find this impact crater. And now I think this is just accepted by most people. There was a giant, you know, there was a giant asteroid that killed the dinosaurs. And in fact, there's a movie based on Walter Alvarez's scientific book. It's called Deep Impact, where the asteroid hits the Earth. And right at the beginning of it, one of the characters yells, Alvin is the one that killed all the dinosaurs, which is, you know, direct reference to this theory. But he writes so engagingly, and he is so humble about all of their missteps that it gives you just this lovely look into what the scientific enterprise can look like. And then what I also find really fascinating about this book is Alvarez is really fighting against this place when the science and religion wars, so it's the 70s and 80s, he's working on this, that the science and religion wars in the U.S. are raging. And scientists, for the most part, particularly those who are doing any sort of geological work, are dead set against any explanation that smacks of an extraordinary one-time event. And what they're doing is they're reacting against a push from a certain segment of society to preserve the 7-day creation and the Great Flood as events that explain something about the natural world. And, you know, it's a complicated interaction, but in part, the scientific establishment pushes back by insisting that what's called catastrophism, that is, explaining anything in the past by saying, and then this huge one-time-only event occurred, is completely unscientific. So you see Walter Alvarez proposing to his colleagues an asteroid could have wiped out the dinosaurs, and like this instant wall go up. We don't believe in catastrophes. say that a catastrophe is an explanation and it just is going to open the door to all sorts of unscientific thinking. And you see them pushing back out of philosophy, not because of what the evidence actually says. So just watching that interplay in this book to me is fascinating. I mean, I have a divinity degree, so, you know, I find this particularly interesting. But it really highlights one of the major fault points in American science in particular. Is it? Yeah. Well, and it's a good read. So, like, you know, like my other favorites, his prose is good. I appreciate good prose. Well, I am actually, I signed a contract in November of 2019, before 2020 began, to write a book about epidemic illness and how it changes our view of ourselves, our culture, and our world. Yeah. I know. So I'm working on this book. It's called Flesh, Blood, Bones, and Breath. That's the working title anyway. And it's going to be coming out from St. Martin's Press. And I got to tell you, it has been the most surreal experience to be writing. And it's about epidemic illness from very ancient times all the way up to the present as a lens for how we understand our existence on Earth with all of this going on around us. It's been just bizarre. So I think the book will probably turn out to be something quite different than what it would have been if I'd been writing it at any other time. But, you know, it's a fascinating topic to be plowing through in 2020. Yeah, so my books, I have my website is SusanWiseBauer.com. That's just my name with no punctuation. And, yeah, I've got information about my books there. You can also follow me on Twitter or on Facebook, again, Susan Weisbauer, and keep up with what I'm doing. There's always something interesting going on. Oh, yeah. Oh, well, I have fondnesses for a number of the unfortunately all guys that I covered in the Story of Western Science. But I have to say, I'm a fan of Michio Kaku, who's the theoretical physicist. I think he has such a fan. He's got that popularizing ability. He's got that ability to give you an image that actually makes sense. I mean, I think I understood relativity for the first time reading his description of it, where he talks about a caterpillar crawling along a crumpled sheet of paper and how far the caterpillar thinks it's going and how far it's going if you measure without the crumples. And I was like, oh, I got that. So I think the first thing I ever read of his was Hyperspace, which he talks, I love time travel. So he talks about parallel universes, time warps in the 10th dimension, but he's got a bunch of books out there. And I just find him to be so smart, so articulate, and so capable of communicating with non-scientists, which is such a fantastic quality for a scientist. Oh, he you know, he popped up. This was funny. I was like, oh, there he is. He popped up at the beginning of World War Z, the movie. It's right at the beginning when they're running the opening credits. He's talking about people who deny the fact that there could be a plague that could change humanity. And it's just about 15 seconds, but that was kind of fun to see. You know, okay, so I may have mentioned I was an English major, and then I did graduate degrees in theology and in English poetry, and then I did a PhD in the history of American religion, meaning I didn't have a whole lot of great science teachers, and I'm so sorry, I don't remember his name, I just remember his face, and I remember how awesome the class was. When I was an undergrad, we had to take a science class, so I took cosmology, which was physics for poets, And it was, you know, physics without any of the equations. And it was an eye-opener. I loved every single minute of it. That's when I first, you know, read Einstein. And I thought, I can understand this stuff. It's not a closed book. That professor was so engaging and so encouraging that I owe him. Well, I think this answer is definitely affected by the fact that it's 2020, but digital libraries. Being able to read and research online and have full text access to books and to journals is such a game changer for me. You know, it takes the kind of research that I do out of the hands of people who only live in specific areas, and it puts it right in mine. I mean, I live on a 100-acre sheep farm in Virginia, and from here, I can join the great conversation, and that has made such a tremendous difference to me. Yep. Lovely to talk to you. Okay. Yeah, that was fun. Let's do it again sometime. I would love that. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.